Hey, this is Dave DeCamp from AntiWar.com, and this is Anti-War News for Tuesday, October 11th, 2022. First story at the top of AntiWar.com today. We got a ton of stuff to go over here. But the first story, Russia launches massive strikes across Ukraine targeting infrastructure. So on Monday, Russia launched one of its largest barrages of missile strikes in Ukraine in its first major coordinated attack on Ukrainian energy and communication infrastructure across the country, marking a significant escalation of the war. Russian President Vladimir Putin said that the missile strikes targeted the energy, military command, and communications facilities of Ukraine. The missile barrage came after the truck bombing of the Kerch Bridge, which connects Russian mainland to Crimea. A day earlier, Putin called the Kerch Bridge bombing a Ukrainian terror attack, and Ukrainian sources confirmed to U.S. media that Kiev was responsible. Now, Monday's strikes targeted nearly every region in Ukraine, including the capital, Kiev, where missiles hit the city center. Other major cities that were targeted include Kharkiv, Dnipro, Lviv, and Odessa, and several other cities. Ukraine's Prime Minister, Denis Shmyhal, said 11 key infrastructure facilities were damaged in 8 separate regions, including Kiev, leaving parts of the country with no electricity, heat, water, or internet. So at the time of the writing of this article, Monday night, Ukrainian authorities had reported 11 people killed in the missile strikes. So if you're watching on the video, I put in this map from South Front, which shows where all the strikes were reported, and it's just across the most of the country. So it was very large-scale attacks by Russia. And Putin, on Monday, he warned of further escalation if Ukrainian attacks on Russian infrastructure continue. He said, quote, "If attempts continue to carry out terror attacks on our territory, Russia's response will be tough and by their scope correspond to the level of threats created for the Russian Federation," end quote. Monday's missile strikes marked a new approach for Putin in his war, as Russia had previously avoided wide-scale attacks on civilian infrastructure, which is a standard tactic for invasions carried out by the U.S. military. For example, the initial phase of the 2003 invasion of Iraq started with a major bombing campaign against infrastructure known as Shock and Awe. So the initial phase of Russia's war, it did involve wide-scale missile strikes across Ukraine, but the targets were primarily military infrastructure. Of course, other targets were hit, civilians were killed. That's the nature of war. But the reality of Russia's war so far is that they really haven't done this before. Now, Russia had targeted energy infrastructure with strikes in Kharkiv after Ukraine made some significant gains in that territory, but it was nowhere near the scale of the strikes that we saw on Monday. And the new phase of Russia's attacks on Ukraine, it came after Russia appointed General Sergei Sorovikin as the commander of Russian forces in Ukraine, and he had previously led Russian forces in Syria. So in response, President Biden, of course, condemned the strikes and said that he would keep supporting Ukraine. And he also spoke with Zelensky and promised that the U.S. would provide advanced air defense systems after these missile strikes. So, yeah, I mean, just another big escalation in the war. And I mean, the question is are we going to be seeing more of this, these types of attacks as the war goes on, as the war continues? All right. So the next one here, Lukashenko, the Belarusian president, he said on Monday that Belarus and Russia agreed to deploy a joint military force in response to tensions on the western borders of the Union state. And the Union state refers to the combined territories of Russia and Belarus. So what it sounds like he's talking about is the bombing of the Crimean Bridge and other Ukrainian attacks on Russian territory, or now what Russia considers its territory in the territories that it annexed in Ukraine. So Lukashenko said, quote, "In the wake of escalations on the western borders of the Union state, we agreed on deploying a regional group of forces of the Russian Federation and the Republic of Belarus, end quote. So he didn't specify where these troops would be deployed, maybe to Belarus's borders, but we're not really sure. He said that Russia and Belarus began combining troops 2 days ago after 2 days ago as of Monday. So after the attack on the Crimean Bridge, the Kerch Bridge, is when he said they started this. And he's claiming that Ukraine is discussing plans to launch attacks on Belarus. He said, quote, "I have already said that Ukraine today, it is not just discussing, but planning strikes on Belarusian territory," end quote. So he didn't provide any evidence for that claim. But I mean, this signals maybe Belarus is preparing to enter the war, but there's no sign yet that that's going to happen. But just the talk of potential attacks on Belarus and talking about deploying troops. He said that it would be madness for Ukraine to open a second front, but he says that the process, nevertheless, that Ukraine has begun the process. He claimed that Ukraine's Western backers are pushing for an attack on Belarus. Russia launched part of its initial invasion from Belarusian territory. That's where they came in through the north when they went down to Kiev in the first phase of the war. But Belarus so far has not entered the war. And the U.S. and its allies, they've really been driving Russia and Belarus closer together, because since the invasion started, a lot of the sanctions they targeted Russia with also targeted Belarus. But it goes back further than that. Back in August 2020, there was a presidential election in Belarus. Lukashenko, the results show that he won, but the U.S. and the EU and this opposition leader who's fled the country, she's in exile. I forget exactly where. I think in one of the Baltic states. But the U.S. has thrown support behind this opposition leader and rejected the results of the election. So the U.S. and the EU started increasing sanctions on Belarus after that election. And that really brought Lukashenko and Putin closer together, because before that, they weren't as close as people kind of assumed that they were. So I think a lot of that Western pressure played a big part in Russia staging its invasion, for being able to do it from Belarusian territory. And Putin said recently that this pressure is pushing the unification process between Russia and Belarus, because back in 1997, way back then, Russia and Belarus signed a treaty known as the Union State that would integrate the two nations. Under the agreement, they would remain a separate sovereign. They would remain separate sovereign states, but Russian and Belarusian citizens would be granted citizenship for both countries and would be able to travel freely. And there are other aspects to that treaty, but it was something that stalled for a long time, again, because relations weren't as good as, you know, we're led to believe. But now with these sanctions, I mean, they're trying to isolate both Russia and Belarus from the global Western-led economic system. So, of course, you know, it's going to bring them closer together. Okay, so the next one, this is a pretty big story here from the Gray Zone. It's from Kit Clarenberg. And according to this report, so the Gray Zone has obtained an April 2022 presentation drawn up by senior British intelligence officers. So this exposes that the British intelligence drew up plans to bomb the Kerch Bridge back in April. About 6 months ago at this point. And some of these plans would involve trained Ukrainian soldiers specifically trained to do this. So almost 6 months after the plan was circulated, the Kerch Bridge was attacked in an October 8th bombing that was apparently overseen by Ukraine's SBU intelligence services. Detailed proposals for providing audacious support to Kiev's maritime raiding operations were drafted at the request of Chris Donnelly, a senior British intelligence operative and veteran high-ranking NATO advisor. The wide-ranging plan's core component was destruction of the bridge over the Kerch Strait. Documents and correspondence plotting the operation were provided by to the Gray Zone by an anonymous source. So the truck bombing, as we know, the Kerch Bridge was blown up by a truck bombing. And that was different from these plans that they drew up. But still, I mean, it really shows that, you know, because we know the British are very involved in training Ukrainian troops. We know there's, according to multiple reports, there's British special operations forces inside Ukraine. So it really just raises the question, okay, how were the British involved in this attack? But it shows that they were also, they wanted Ukraine to do something like this. But this is very interesting. I would suggest people to just go to the Gray Zone and read this report. And they actually link to the complete blueprint to the plans that were drawn up by these British officials. And it sounds like they were discussing things like missile strikes on the bridge. Again, different than what happened, but still, I mean, it just goes to show how intimately involved they are. And as Clarenberg points out in this article, this was back in April. This was around the time that Boris Johnson reportedly went to Ukraine to discourage Zelensky not to sign any deals with Russia, saying that the collective West, as they call it, was not ready for something like that. So they're scuttling peace talks while plotting this attack, which has led to this major Russian escalation now. So speaking of peace talks, the next one is interesting. Mike Mullen, retired admiral and a former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff for George W. Bush and Barack Obama, was on TV on Sunday on ABC calling for the U.S. to push for negotiations between Ukraine and Russia to help bring an end to the war in Ukraine. So this is something that you don't see much from former U.S. officials that get booking on, you know, mainstream news shows like this. So Mullen, he said that President Biden should back off his talk of nuclear Armageddon and work to end the war. He said, quote, "President Biden's language, we're about at the top of the language scale, if you will. And I think we need to back off that a little bit and do everything we possibly can to try to get to the table to resolve this thing," end quote. He said that it was up to Secretary of State Antony Blinken and other diplomats to figure out how to bring Zelensky and Putin to the table for negotiations. He said, quote, "As is typical in any war, it's got to end. And usually there are negotiations associated with that. The sooner the better, as far as I'm concerned," end quote. So when discussing the risk of nuclear war, Mullen said that he has to take Putin seriously since he has many options. He could potentially use lower yield tactical nuclear weapons. And he described Putin as a cornered animal. But despite the risks, the Biden administration has not shown interest in pursuing diplomacy with Russia, at least publicly. Blinken has only spoken with his Russian counterpart, Sergei Lavrov, once since February 24th. Once that we know of publicly. Again, there's always a chance of back channel talks. And I hope if Biden really thinks that the risk of nuclear Armageddon is so high, that means he's talking to Russia, that they have some back channel things going on here. But now I just have to mention that it is our fundraiser at antiwar.com, and we need your help. We are totally reliant on our readers to get by. We don't get any sort of corporate money. It's really incredible that we're able to run this site, on donations from our readers. So we need your help. We have a great endorsement from Colonel Douglas McGregor at the top of the page. One of the very few people, you know, he gets on Fox News sometimes and other news shows, speaking out against this policy of arming Ukraine and supporting this war on Russia's border. He's just been so outspoken about it. And it's great to see that he likes us and he endorses us. So please listen to McGregor. Go to antiwar.com/donate. And you'll see all the ways you can help us. And there's a number there you could call. You could speak with Angela Keaton. And again, you could contact me if there's any questions you have about us. But please consider, if you listen to this podcast, this is all possible because of antiwar.com. So please consider donating. Okay, back to the news. We still have a lot of stuff to get through here. So the next one here, Putin might meet with Erdogan, the Turkish president, to discuss possible talks between Russia and the West. So this is according to a report from Reuters. The Kremlin said Monday that Putin might meet with Erdogan this week to discuss a Turkish proposal for hosting talks between Russia and the West. Erdogan and Putin are expected to visit Kazakhstan later this week, where they could hold this meeting. And Dmitry Peskov, the Kremlin spokesman, he said that Russia has not yet received signals about the prospects for talks with the West, but said that Moscow was open to discussing the idea. So Turkey has emerged as a broker between the warring sides in Ukraine, and they helped successfully negotiate the grain export deal that has unlocked Ukraine's Black Sea ports. Turkey also hosted the last known in-person peace talks between Ukraine and Russia that were held in Istanbul at the end of March. And virtual negotiations followed that, which showed some promise. But the peace talks ultimately failed, reportedly due in part to pressure from Boris Johnson, as I discussed earlier. But what was interesting, which I was reminded of by a recent piece in our viewpoint section by Ted Snyder, was that after it was clear that the negotiations hit a dead end back in April, Turkey's foreign minister said that there were some countries within NATO that wanted the war to continue and that they wanted Russia to become weaker. And if you look at the date that he said this, just a few days later was when Lloyd Austin came back from Kiev and said that the U.S. wants to see a weakened Russia. So I think he was onto something there. But, you know, hopefully this shows something materializes out of this. It seems like Erdogan might be starting to push more for talks. Okay, the next one is from Responsible Statecraft, and it's about all these amendments that the Senate included in the National Defense Authorization Act, which is the military spending bill for next year, for 2023. Senators have filed over 900 amendments, and some of them include massive increases in spending. So this always happens. Where we're at right now with the NDAA, the House passed its version, and the House representatives submitted over 1,000 amendments to that one, and dozens were added, but not all of the ones that are submitted get approved. But it's just really amazing how much stuff they try to pack into this. But some notable things here that were mentioned in this Responsible Statecraft article is that one proposal from Senator Josh Hawley, Missouri Republican, it would authorize $15 billion to the Pentagon for a Taiwan Security Assistance Initiative to accelerate Taiwan's deployment of asymmetric defense capabilities required to deter or, if necessary, defeat an invasion by the People's Republic of China. So $15 billion, and from my reading of the proposal, it's kind of, this stuff is very kind of tough to read and follow. They don't make it simple for a reason, I think, but from my understanding is that $15 billion would be over 5 years. But that's significant. That's a lot of money. And also Bob Menendez, the head of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, and Lindsey Graham, they're trying to get the Taiwan Policy Act, which I've covered a lot, that would give Taiwan $6.5 billion in military aid. And it would do other things to fundamentally alter the U.S. policy toward Taiwan. They're trying to roll it into the NDAA as opposed to holding a vote in the Senate and House. So this is definitely something to keep an eye on. I'm not sure when they're going to decide on all these amendments and see which ones make it. And then the Senate and the House, they have to negotiate to reach the final version. So then even if the Senate amendments and the House amendments, not all of them might make it to the final one. But anyway, speaking of Taiwan, the next one here, Taiwan's president Tsai Ing-wen said on Monday in comments aimed at Beijing that war is absolutely not an option for resolving the dispute over Taiwan. Tsai said this in a speech marking Taiwan's National Day. She said, quote, "I want to make clear to Beijing, to the Beijing authorities, that armed confrontation is absolutely not an option for our two sides," end quote. So Tsai's Democratic Progressive Party, the DPP, they reject the One China principle and consider Taiwan to be an independent state, although they've never formally declared independence. That's, Tsai has never done that. because that's something that they believe that would likely spark Chinese military intervention. China has been clear that such a declaration would, they would take action if that happened. But still, I mean, she considers Taiwan to be a de facto independent state. So for her independence-leaning views, Beijing's severed official contacts with Taiwan when she was elected president in 2016. Tsai called for China to respect Taiwan's sovereignty to resume contacts. She said, quote, "Only by respecting the commitment of the Taiwanese people to our sovereignty, democracy, and freedom can there be a foundation for resuming constructive interaction across the Taiwan Strait," end quote. So while warning against war, Tsai also spoke of Taiwan's efforts to increase its military spending and domestic weapon production. They're ramping up the production of precision missiles and high-performance naval vessels. And Tsai said that Taiwan is working to, quote, "acquire various small, high-mobile precision weapons that will help us develop comprehensive asymmetric warfare capabilities, ensuring that Taiwan is fully prepared to respond to external military threats," end quote. So Taiwan is going to be able to do this a lot more if they get all this billions in military aid that these senators are pushing for. I think we're going to see something. We're not sure exactly what the amount will be yet, but I think a few billion is going to be headed Taiwan's way pretty soon. And tensions have been high in the region since House Speaker Nancy Pelosi visited Taiwan. Her visit sparked the largest ever Chinese military exercises around the island, and China has kept up the pressure by flying planes across the median line. All right, so the next article here is from the South China Morning Post. It's an interesting one. Taiwan's opposition Kuomintang Party, the KMT, which they're a little more Beijing-friendly, which is interesting because they were the party of Chiang Kai-shek, and they ruled Taiwan under martial law until the late 1980s. Taiwan was a military dictatorship until then. But now, you know, they're not like the DPP. They're not independence-minded like them. They have a different interpretation of the One China principle than China does. You know, they're not willing to accept themselves as a province of China, but they're just they're just different from the DPP in what they want. But this article says that they're looking to regain more influence in Washington, and they want to open up a liaison office in to rebuild ties with the U.S. Okay, the next one here, this is from Kyle Anzalone and Connor Freeman at the Libertarian Institute. And it's interesting, top-ranking Democratic senators Bob Menendez, Democrat from New Jersey, and Chris Murphy, Democrat from Connecticut, have called for a fundamental change to the relationship between Washington and Riyadh after the kingdom announced it would cut oil production. So this is interesting. I mean, Menendez is a serious hawk. He has no problem with what Saudi Arabia is doing in Yemen, you know, blockading the country and its history of bombing civilians there. Thankfully, it doesn't look like the Saudi air campaign has resumed since the ceasefire expired. So that's good. But this is, he says and said in a statement that enough is enough. And he wants a change here. So this is, I guess, you know, kind of a good sign that a lot of the Democrats are turning on Saudi Arabia, and their Murphy and Menendez are calling to end arms sales, which is pretty significant. But at the same time, who knows how serious this is, because I think the Democrats are taking that move as kind of a shot against Biden because it came right before midterms. Their decision to cut oil production, OPEC's decision to cut oil production. So they're kind of taking it more personally. But anyway, the next one here, this is from Nick Terse at Responsible Statecraft, and it says the Pentagon does not know if it trained Burkina Faso coup leader. So there was another coup in Burkina Faso late last month. And usually when there is a coup in Africa, it turns out that the Pentagon has trained the coup leader at some point or another. So this is saying that the Pentagon is not, it's not clear. They haven't given an answer if they have trained this new coup leader, Captain Ibrahim Traore, of Burkina Faso. So it's a good article. It's a good read. If you want to go get more information on that, Nick Terse, he's really the best one that covers AFRICOM operations and across Africa and just issues that really don't get much coverage at all. All right, the next one here, there's another U.S. drone strike in Syria, according to a Kurdish-Syrian security official speaking to the Associated Press. And this official said that the strike killed a ISIS member in a northern Syrian area that is controlled by Turkish-backed forces. So this is just, again, it looks like the U.S. operations against ISIS in Syria have kind of stepped up recently. Last week, CENTCOM said that it killed three ISIS members in airstrikes in a raid. And then on Saturday, CENTCOM said that a rocket was fired at a base in northeast Syria that was housing U.S. troops. So escalation in the U.S. war in Syria continues. Again, it seems like they've been targeting ISIS. I haven't seen any reports to the contrary, you know, saying that some of the strikes didn't kill ISIS members, but it's just something to keep an eye on, as there is always a chance that the U.S. launches, you know, major airstrikes against other groups inside Syria. And as I always mention, the U.S. maintains an occupation force of about 900 troops in eastern Syria, and this presence is opposed by the Syrian government. And the area of the country that it occupies is where most of Syria's oil resources are. All right, so the last news story here, this is from Kyle and Connor at the Libertarian Institute again. North Korea claims to develop new nuclear weapons technology. So Pyongyang claims it is now able to conduct missile launches using underwater silos. The announcement came after a series of North Korean missile tests over the past 2 weeks. Meanwhile, South Korea is concerned about its air fleet's reliability. So Kim Jong-un oversaw the successful test of these underwater launch missiles, according to North Korean state media. So this is just another more escalation in the tensions between the North and the South, just tit for tat missile tests and South Korean war games with the U.S. and other missile tests. So the escalations, the tensions continue in this part of the world, and now North Korea is saying they have these new missile silos. But that's it for the news. That was a lot of stuff. I hope I wasn't too short with some of those stories. Always go to antiwar.com and do some reading. But we have a good viewpoint, few good viewpoints as always. We have a great one from Ron Paul. It's time to tell Biden that we say no to nuclear war, which I really liked. But that's it for the news for me. I will be back tomorrow with more. You can contact the show, news@antiwar.com. Please help us with our fundraiser, antiwar.com/donate. But that's it. I will talk to you tomorrow. Thanks for listening.